Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, the scariest horror movie endings of all time. We asked 500,000 horror fans online that question. Actually, we asked it in two different forms at two different times. One was scariest horror movie ending and one was best horror movie ending. And we got thousands of answers back, which are basically votes. So we're going to break them all down on this episode and then give you some of our personal picks. One of the things I got really excited about as the voting transpired was just how many movies were getting significant support. Sometimes when we do questions like these on the Horror Weekly Facebook page and on the Threads page, what happens is we kind of know what's going to happen, right? So if we do, like, what's the best horror remake of all time, there's going to be quite a few different answers, but the viable ones are going to be less than a dozen, and they're all going to kind of stack up and be similar in vote totals with maybe one clear winner pulling away. We know we're going to be talking about John Carpenter's The Thing. We know we're going to talk about Cronenberg's The Fly. We know we're going to be talking about The Blob from 1988. We know Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead is going to show up. And if we get lucky, there's going to be a couple dark horses that get a significant amount of votes for some reason, like The Crazies or Let Me In. But it's going to cluster. But on this question of the scariest or best horror movie ending, there is a lot of voting across a lot of different movies. And some of the movies are either obscure-ish or they're just not talked about that often, or they're never at the top of any other kind of list that you make or we do on the podcast. So seeing so many movies like that punching above their weight, so to speak, in this voting was awesome. Can't wait to get into them. I'll give you one quick example while we're talking about it. Greg Charles said in his vote, even though the movie was terrible, the ending to Kingdom of the Spiders has always been one of my all-time favorite endings. And that's part of why I'm enjoying this topic so much, because the ending of Kingdom of the Spiders from 1977 is by light years the best part of that film. I mean, it's a really weirdly watchable, terrible movie. It's got an all-time great William Shatner performance, of course. But that ending is absolutely haunting, and I know a lot of horror fans personally that ending affected. But before we get into breaking down the movies themselves, you know what we like to do here is see if there was any patterns that kind of emerged in the general voting and discussion. And one thing that really jumped out at me is that meta horror movies like Scream or Zombieland or Behind the Mask or Wes Craven's New Nightmare never showed up in the voting, like, at all, with one exception, which we'll talk about in just a sec. But it really made me wonder why it's hard to end a meta horror movie well. Like, for example, Tucker and Dale vs. Evil is one of my favorite movies ever. It's a hilarious movie. It's quality all the way through, except for an atrocious ending. Like, it's only the last, I don't know, 15 seconds or so, but it's just so bad. If I remember right, it's got some guy in the background clubbing a woman unconscious and, like, dragging her off like a fucking caveman. It's just a weird misstep for a movie that good. And Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which we were just talking about on the Horror Weekly page, is an outright masterpiece. It's either the second or third best film in the entire Elm Street franchise. But I remember the ending always makes me feel a little let down. And then there's the Scream series itself, which feels like one good ending out of the whole series, maybe? I mean, don't get me wrong, that with one exception, they're all decent. It's just the endings aren't the first things that jump to mind when you think of the Scream franchise. So either it's luck, or there's something about having to break the fourth wall that directors, when grappling with it, weakens how they stick the landing at the ending somehow. With one exception in the voting, which I have to say I disagreed with, which is Cabin in the Woods. But that's okay. I'm really glad it was there, because it led me to discover not really a pattern number two, but, like, one thing that really jumped out from the voting halfway through. was that how movies end really clarifies who the people in them are, what their character is. It's like when Heath Ledger's Joker says in that interrogation room when he's trying to bait the one officer left protecting him so he can get out and get his phone call. And he tells the guy, you know, when people die, they show you who they really are. So in a sense, I knew your friends better than you. Do you want me to tell you which one of them were cowards? The endings of movies really show you who people are. I'll give you an example. I don't know why this never really jumped out at me until I started prepping to record on this topic. But in The Ring from 2002 with Naomi Watts, her character Rachel does a pretty awful thing at the end. Now, I registered it when I saw the movie. I've seen the movie a few times. Clearly, it's you don't miss that she's doing something awful by unleashing this phenomenon on the world and carrying out kind of Samara's wishes. But because there's a child that's involved, because her son is involved, I sort of gave her an unconscious pass. But it's pretty awful that that was the solve that she came up with. I know it's seemingly the only one that's there, right? Although other people solved in different ways, like Brian Cox's character earlier in the movie. I mean, one of the things that gives horror movies so much resonance is that idea of sacrifice for the greater good. It's what motivates the crew in The Thing to not let this get unleashed on the planet. It's what motivates Father Damien Karras, Jason Miller's character in The Exorcist, to take the Pazuzu inside of him and then chuck himself out a window, sacrificing himself to give Reagan a future and also to defeat the demon. But what Rachel is doing at the end of The Ring is the opposite of self-sacrifice. So it's very clarifying. Actually, I rewatched some of the movie after kind of thinking this through, and you can see like streaks of selfishness in how she's operating in the movie that I wasn't catching before. And it's not, I mean, she's in an extraordinarily bad circumstance, right? Like a completely unfair circumstance. So it's not like I'm trashing her character saying she's an awful person or whatever. It's just interesting when you stack it up against what how other horror characters behave at the end, how this kind of stands out a little more than I realized. The ending of Jordan Peele's Get Out is very clarifying about the characters. Well, not just the characters, but also kind of the themes of the movie themselves, right? What the ending of Get Out says is that Chris is still going to spend the rest of his life scared, even though he defeated the family here. And he's going to be scared because we were scared as audience view, as the viewers, when those police light colors spun up at the end. We got scared for him, and we all know why we got scared. And that why is not going away. And the ending of Get Out also tells me that we all need best friends who are motherfucking TSA agents. Even though the ending of the original Nightmare on Elm Street aged a little bit poorly visually, the part of Nancy's mom getting sucked through the door, it actually is a perfect distillation of what's great about this character. The car, the roof of the car being Freddy's sweater pattern is hilarious, objectively. But what he does to the mom pulling her through the door is savage. It's almost like the fact that he got semi-defeated in the movie has made him determined to like fuck around less and just like be more direct about the killing. And that carries right over into Elm Street 2, which starts with one of the all-time great openings of a horror movie ever, but shows Freddy getting into a scarier mode. Which brings us back to Cabin in the Woods, because Dana and Marty at the end of Cabin in the Woods do the absolute opposite of self-sacrificing. They are the worst people. It fascinates me. Like horror fans a lot of times love to discuss kill counts, right? Like Jason Voorhees has, I don't know, I think it's somewhere just south of 200, depending on whether you count the people in the space station and Jason X or not. But Dana and Marty have the highest kill count in maybe the history of horror. And they killed you. They decided you needed to die. They literally sat there and thought this through, and they were like, nope, humanity's not worth saving. I mean, they were going to die anyway. So it's not even like a sacrifice. It's actively malicious. So I think we can comfortably crown Dana and Marty as the worst villains in horror movie history. I knew we should have been rooting for Stephen, Gary. The Black Mirror episode, USS Callister, is one of my favorites. It's not perfect. It's got flaws, obviously. But one of the things that really pushes that over the top to something that works for me is, and this is going to sound silly because, I mean, it's just a kind of satirical, fun episode, but it's the self-sacrifice of Jimmy Simpson's character, Walton, who lets him get fried into maybe being fried eternally. I mean, I don't think that's how that works out, because I think the game shuts down at the end, or the game he's in shuts down, so he'll get some peace. But he was certainly risking it. Imagine feeling like burning alive forever, for eternity. And he does it just to give the ship back its power so that they can escape out of this hellish circumstance they're in. And he plays that scene really straight and pretty emotionally, with a great fuck you moment at the end of it. And I don't know, that just gives that whole thing like an emotional spice level that I really appreciated, which is why I think I have such an aversion to the ending of Cabin in the Woods, which otherwise is a great movie. So there's no way I'm going to be able to cover all the voting, so I'll link the post so you can go check out at least the main post we asked in a bunch of places, so you can see for yourselves, because I'm going to leave a lot out. But let's start with the lower in the voting, right? The ones that got some support but didn't crack the top 10. Aaron Don Gilmer said Angel Heart, which Louis Cypher, bless you. Thank you for bringing it up. You know I'm obsessed with that movie. By the way, she does an incredible podcast with her partner Hillary called Manic Movie Monday. They are not just great horror fans. They are super smart, really insightful, and incredibly charming. So definitely go check that podcast out. But Angel Heart was, alas, not anywhere near the top 10. Now, this is what I was talking about getting excited about this, because I have never seen this movie's name show up in any episode voting we've ever done, which is 2019's Saint Maud, a great film. Not only is this one of the greatest visually executed endings in a horror movie I had seen in a long time, it's also such a pleasure just to see a filmmaker get it right. The reason that ending works is because of how little, how brief they show you what actually is happening compared to the visuals you're seeing throughout most of the last sequence. There are movies like Repulsion, for example, that have great creepy endings, but the camera push in on the photograph goes on, to my taste, a little too long. It draws some of the venom out of the sting of that ending, just because they milk it for too much. Saint Maud is having none of that. This is like a stiletto in the heart, you're dead and hit the ground before you even know it kind of ending. Psycho 2 got more than 100 votes with the magnificent shovel to the head poison tea ending scene. And Psycho 2, again, is a movie that has never shown up with any significant votes in any other list we've ever tried to build here. That is one of the few movie endings that made me feel like I was a bad person, because I was laughing so hard after it happened, but it's like an awful event. The Menu got around 100 votes in the Cheeseburgers Rule. John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness did really well. but not as well as John Carpenter's The Thing, which was in the top 15. It actually was in 15th place. The Shining and John Carpenter's Halloween didn't even make it into the top, I don't know, might have even been 30, which is kind of amazing. There honestly weren't that many franchise films that made the top 10, which is also interesting to me. Blair Witch Project didn't make the list, which hurt me a little because that ending really affected me. I know this is making half of the people listening mad. I'm so sorry. But I loved that movie when it first came out, and I thought the ending was really inscrutable, which I like. Another movie that punched above its weight was Life, the Jake Gyllenhaal and Ryan Reynolds movie. But let's get into the actual winners. So at number 10, 2019 must have been a good year for endings because it comes in with Ready or Not. This blew my mind that when this started getting tons of votes. Not that because of the quality, the ending is magnificent, but just because, again, I didn't expect to see so many newer movies. I also didn't expect to see a movie that's kind of comedic. And clearly a lot of this voting was for best and not scariest. It's going to be a mixed bag in these top 10. So this is definitely not scariest, but definitely was for best. And it's great to see it here because Samara Weaving was amazing. The visual of it is just iconic. It reminds me so much of the ending of Heathers, which is one of my favorite films. At number 9 is Saw. Now, the one thing I know for sure about this is my favorite music that ever played out a horror movie ending. Just the music going as Jigsaw's exiting is, I mean, I can hear it note for note in my head while I'm talking about it. And that was a scary and impactful moment because your brain is reeling. This is one of those endings where you're off balance as the movie ends. It's like you're in a boxing ring and a boxer hit you and you're rocked back on your heels and you go to fight back and they're not even in the ring anymore. They've left the building, vanished. And just leaving someone entombed in darkness like that, it gave me very much the same kind of feeling I got at the ending of The Pit and The Pendulum, which is a terrifying ending if you haven't seen Pit and the Pendulum. Just the visual of it. It's kind of hard for me to look at. I don't post about it often because I don't like to pull the picture and have to look at it to turn it into a post. Now, this is interesting because at number 8, we have The Descent. And The Descent has two endings, really. There's the UK ending, which is incredibly bleak and amazing and is the one that got all the votes. And then there's the US ending, which is a little more upbeat. But if you haven't seen Neil Marshall's The Descent, see it. And if you haven't seen the UK ending, check it out. Man, that ending just leveled me. It was one of those sit and can't get up and think about it as the credits roll kind of endings. And I don't necessarily want to spoil it here, but it is terrifying, but the visuals are combined with the sounds of the crawlers, and when you put that recipe together, knockout. At number 7 is Lucio Fulci's The Beyond. This is really intriguing because I love The Beyond. It's my favorite movie of Fulci's. It's one of three in his Gates of Hell trilogy, all of which I love, but it's the ending here is interesting because I don't think, because The Beyond essentially has almost no plot, you can't really get to know and care about the characters because everything that's happening in this movie is happening in a blender of meaning. So you care about them. You have some empathy for them, but it's not like you fell in love with them the way you fall in love with like a Sidney Prescott or Hooper and Brody in Jaws, another movie that didn't make the top 20, which surprised me. But anyway, the fact that this ending affects so many horror fans without that emotional allegiance to the characters necessarily, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe let me know message the page and tell me if we're like really attached to these people and their fates at the end of the movie. But it's just an overwhelming triumph of visual genius then, right? It's not about the character's fate. It's about how that situation is depicted. And the visuals here are amazing. It's such a unique depiction of hell with everything all grayed out. It's like an album from The Cure come to life and become a movie. It's like hell got intermingled with purgatory or limbo, so it's part one, part the other. It's just absolutely haunting. It's one of the few horror movies I've ever had an actual nightmare about. At number six, we have Pet Sematary. Joe Rogerson said, "Been watching horror since I was three. To this day, one and only one movie has scared me, and it's Pet Sematary. It's too real, and I don't mean people coming back. I mean that grief is so all-consuming that even if you know someone would come back feral and murderous like Timmy or Gage did, you do it anyway. Just too real. So him burying Rachel and that ending, cold shivers and sad inevitability." Great comment, Joe. Thank you for sharing it. Speaking of Stephen King, at number five comes Brian De Palma's Carrie. Now, I remember shivering the first time I saw the ending of Carrie. And, I mean, what an amazing genre this is that we get to talk about here. Because to have a movie moment that you remember over a decade of time, the physical reaction that you had to it is just something that most of the other movie genres, as great as they are, can't quite deliver. And this one, I remember I almost fell out of my chair. Just masterful execution. And this one comes down to pacing, just like that amazing jump scare from Exorcist 3. It's the patience with which this final moment is set up to be sprung on us. Ooh. At number four is George Romero's Night of the Living Dead. And it's, I mean, such a potent, interesting gut punch of an ending. Literally pulling no punches. But here's the thing. As a filmmaker, you can have this idea. Like, I'm just going to take out one of the most iconic characters that's ever going to be created for horror cinema. And, you know, you can visually execute it like we were just talking about Brian De Palma's Carrie. You can do all that, but you're still missing something, which is an amazing line to accompany it. And the magic of "that's another one for the fire." Just seeing this get the votes and then thinking through why this is still so effective after all of this time. Because let's be honest, there aren't a lot of old movies on this list. Movies that probably would have been on this list if we were doing this vote 20 years in the past, like Psycho or Bride of Frankenstein. They're just, you know, wiped away a bit, unfortunately. But this Night of the Living Dead ending, man, I mean, I know movies are a visual medium, but words are still royalty in the recipe of getting to us as an audience. And that line has to be in my top 10 of lines that, like, even thinking about them make me queasy. At number three is Ari Aster's Midsommar. Now, this is interesting because we're just talking about Psycho, and I feel like the smile that Florence Pugh delivers at the end of this is a little similar to what Norman Bates is doing at the end of the original Psycho, but obviously for vastly different reasons. But aside from her incredible acting, I think one of the things that really makes this ending work is that there's the events that just happened before it, the burning, the bear situation, and kind of as you're emotionally catching up to what all this must be meaning to her character, that's still like on the screen somehow, even though it's not being shown, as we're just focusing closer and closer on her in that crazy dress and her face, it's like you take a layer of cellophane and lay it over the page of a book and read the page through the cellophane. Like, there's two endings happening here. The outrage of what you just witnessed is still in your eyes as you're processing the ending of this movie. And that layering effect is, I think, one of the reasons that made this movie rise so high up in the rankings, along with a ton of other. There were great comments, like people giving individual reasons why this really struck them. So I don't speak for them. But to me, it's not just that, the fact that it's visually amazing and delivered with an emotional jab to the heart, but it's also that what just happened before it was so well executed by the filmmaker. All right, at number two, I'm going to have to change the kind of topics we talk about on this podcast, because I'm going to get real sick of seeing this movie's name. Sorry. Is The Mist. I'm actually surprised it wasn't number one. And we just talked about this literally on the last podcast episode we did, so there's no need to go over this again. But obviously, it's one of the most talked about and memorable endings that's ever been pulled off in a horror film. At number one, to my surprise, is The Others. And I'm not surprised it's on the list. I'm surprised that it's number one, and it's not a quality thing. This is one of my favorite movies of all time, and one of my favorite endings of all time. And Henry James' Turn of the Screw, which this is loosely based on, is one of my favorite things I've ever read. So I'm definitely I'm team The Others. But I don't see it talked about that frequently in our community. Some, but not like top of mind necessarily. So the fact that it won, and won by a decent amount of votes, is a little startling to me, but I love it. So it's a testament to the quality of the twist, which even like Sixth Sense-ish, that's hard to say. If you kind of scented that twist coming, it's the way that it's delivered is so, it's black as night. And aside from just the craftsmanship that goes into this, I think there's an interesting thing happening between the audience, the viewers, and the movie itself, which is this movie is going to haunt you. The ending is going to haunt you. And they're telling you that the characters, spoiler, are ghosts. So it matches up what they're doing to you in the real world, what they're doing to other people in the movie. And that's very rare and very scary. It would be like if Hannibal Lecter came out and chopped off your fingers and made himself a sandwich out of them. You don't want your horror characters matching up with their impact on you in the real world with what they're able to pull off in the four corners of the film. But what do ghosts do? They disturb you. They linger. They're mysterious. They can't be fully explained. And all of that is happening in your mind and heart as the movie is working its final magic effect on you. There's a word in Hebrew, I can't pronounce it, and I don't even know how to spell it off the top of my head. I just remember reading this somewhere from Harold Bloom, where he had said that there's a word, it's something like devar, and it means a word that is an action in the real world at the same time it's a meaning or a sound. So it does the thing it says. And the others is doing what the characters are doing. It's doing it to you. Just powerful, powerful stuff. Now, I'm going to throw in a couple of my personal picks that didn't get any traction in the voting for understandable reasons when you hear what they are, but I think are just absolutely remarkable endings to horror movies, or in one case, TV show. So I'm going to talk about Twin Peaks: The Return first. I think Twin Peaks The Return is the most successful artistic achievement on the screen of at least the last 5 years. And I'm going to treat it like a movie, just like we treat the Salem's Lot miniseries like a movie, or the It 1990 miniseries as a movie. David Lynch directed every episode of The Return. He's a filmmaker. And I think even MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in, New York, did a screening of The Return, showing it all at once like a movie, which, yeah, man, that must have been a marathon watch. But the ending of this is the most terrifying moment of my viewing life in terms of endings, right? Like, I had an equally terrified moment way back in the day from the original Twin Peaks series, but that was the murder of Maddie, and that was not the ending of the show. The ending of the show was unsettling, but it was just a completely bizarre cliffhanger because of how the show got massacred by the network. So what's special here? Well, it's hard to think of another director who have faced such a high level of expectations for a project than what David Lynch was facing for the return of Twin Peaks season 3, to bring something so beloved, not mass beloved. Twin Peaks was never a mass phenomenon. I mean, I guess it sort of was when it first aired, but that faded really quick, right? It's a smaller cadre of very, very devoted, passionate fans, of whom I am one. But to bring a thing like this back after a quarter of a century. So I wanted to get a gauge on just how unusual this was. So, for example, there were only 16 years between Rocky V and Rocky Balboa. And there were less than 10 years between Rocky Balboa and Creed. So even though it felt like Rocky was gone for forever, it was a full decade less than how long Twin Peaks was gone. It feels like they've been fighting over the rights to Friday the 13th forever, but it's only been 14 years between the 2009 entry and now. And we do have a Crystal Lake series coming. They keep pushing it, but I think it will finally drop next year. So imagine that Crystal Lake series not coming out and nothing else Friday or Jason Voorhees happening for another 12 years from right now when you're listening to this podcast. That's how long it would take for that gap to equal the distance between the last aired episode of Twin Peaks and its return. Or even better, the last Seinfeld season, or the last episode, the finale aired in 1998, I think. So if it relaunched now, that would be mathematically close, still a little behind, but not enough to really matter. So it would be exactly analogous to like Jerry Seinfeld relaunching the Seinfeld series now with that like level of expectations. But even then, it wouldn't be nearly what Lynch faced. And the reason is, if the Seinfeld reboot happened tomorrow, critics would primarily only be asking one thing, and audiences too. Is it funny? Right? Like, it didn't catch the vibe of it so much, or maybe it felt like a fail in some things, or maybe the new characters they would try weren't working out, or the old characters they were bringing back looked just sad. Like, you know, there could be flaws in it, right? But if it was just fucking funny, then it would just work. It would be a success. That's all it would need. Twin Peaks The Return? Like, what would the fans even be asking? I wouldn't even know how to articulate, as someone who loves the series, what I wanted from Lynch when I heard news that the reboot was happening. I'd like match the vibe, but like, it's one of the most complicated TV show vibes ever created. Like, it was funny and sinister and murderous and random and unexplainable. Like, what yardstick were we ever going to use to measure the success or failure of the effort? Not the obvious stuff, not the ratings and the numbers and all that stuff, but just like, does it work, right? Like, just because something fails financially, like John Carpenter's The Thing did, doesn't mean it's not a masterpiece. But my God, people, the ending of this. So first of all, the series was incredible. And I get it was not for everyone, but Twin Peaks never was for everyone. And there were some things in it that weren't even for me. I felt like the Dougie thing, while a genius gambit to prolong the return of Dale Cooper way farther than I think any major creator would have even dared. Like, I don't know how he got the latitude to even do it. It's absurd. It would be like they, when they did the reboot of the Halloween, the new trilogy, 2018 Halloween Kills, Halloween Ends, if Michael Myers didn't show up in any of the movies until like the last 15 minutes of Ends. And I know some of you feel like that's what happened in Ends, and we can respectfully disagree, but imagine if Halloween 2018 and Halloween Kills also didn't have Michael Myers. It was that insane what Lynch did with this. And episode 8 was truly special. It might be my favorite hour of television I've ever consumed. And it might be the favorite effect I've ever seen it have, had an airing of something have on an audience. It's similar to what happened, the shockwave that happened to audiences the way The Sopranos ended, but this was like episode 8. This wasn't even the ending. This is like dead center of the series. And just what happened in that episode was haunting. And the release of Oppenheimer coming is weirdly synchronous. Because if Oppenheimer is as good as I expect it to be, it might be the first feeling I have on this similar topic, atomic unleashing of evil, that I had with episode 8. So the series is special. The moments were incredible, but the ending, flat out terrifying and something really unique. So I have become convinced, as I rewatched the whole series recently, that the Laura Palmer's house, Sarah Palmer's house, her family house, is, I think, the most haunted house ever put on screen. I think it outdoes Hill House. I think it outdoes the Overlook Hotel. I know that's not a house, but residence. I think it outdoes Amityville, especially now that the Amityville house is like flying around and attacking people through their toilets and going into space. And I saw an ad in Fangoria magazine for Amityville Glory Hole. Don't know what that is, but that sounds awful. Or possibly amazing. Who knows? You always got to give things a chance. But the Palmer house was shot so benign in some circumstances in the old Twin Peaks, and then so absolutely sinister. There's the shots of the house before the absolutely awful murder scene when the Laura Palmer's killer is revealed. The shots of the house with the tree creeping over it are the most gothic things I've ever seen on American television. And if you haven't seen Twin Peaks The Return and you haven't seen the ending, I can't spoil it, really. I mean, I guess I could spoil the description of what happens, but the meaning is really up to each individual viewer. But basically, I think they're in a trap parallel universe at this point. Cooper is bringing Laura Palmer back after all these years to her childhood home. He's driving her back to Twin Peaks from where she was in Odessa. She doesn't know who she is, and it's complicated. He has an alternate personality named Richard. Of course, it's David Lynch. It's complicated. But essentially, he's Cooper. So he brings her back, parks in front of the house, and then goes up. Now, here's an amazing thing about this. So I apologize if I'm mispronouncing her name. There's a woman named Mary Reber. She is one of the most unlikely superstars I can imagine. She gives such a haunting performance in the very tiny little bit of screen time she gets here as the current occupant of the Palmer house. But what's really cool is that she actually does own the house. When Cooper and Laura Palmer are standing outside her door asking her questions as the owner of the house, she actually is the real life actual owner of the real life Palmer home. And I don't know how much of a Twin Peaks fan she was before this happened, but she is incredible on Twitter, a place I only really go now to see her posts because she hasn't come to Threads yet, damn it. But she's so insightful. She's so enthusiastic, but she also has like this slightly sinister tone about her posts, which is completely unexpected. Like, just imagine a random citizen buying, you know, a famous place and becoming a character in the show after all these years, and then becoming like a knowledgeable aficionado of that phenomenon. Just incredibly cool. So Cooper identifies himself as FBI, asks her some questions while she's standing in the doorway, not letting them in. And she's also ominously talking to someone on the other side of the half-open door that we can't see. We can only hear like mumbling and muttering. So we don't know if that's a real person or if she's being prompted these answers. Like, is she a hostage of evil? Is she part of the evil force? Is there no evil happening in the scenario at all? That, like, Cooper is just totally off track and that's just a normal person owning a completely haunted and spectacularly evil place. We're never really sure. But here's the thing. So, okay, bear with me here because I love this so much. All right. So Cooper, the character of Dale Cooper, anytime they do a list of like the 100 greatest TV characters of all time, this character is always in the top 20, top 10. It's one of the great performances of our time. Kyle MacLachlan is a magnificent actor, but the character himself is very, very unique and special. There's no one quite like him anywhere else on any other show or movie for that matter. And one of the most appealing things about Cooper is his calm certainty, which really is the thing that anchored the entire Twin Peaks phenomenon. Twin Peaks, let's face it, is too chaotic and too crazy to succeed without something holding it down. He's like the ballast in the hot air balloon. And of course, he does really strange off-the-wall things too, but he's so calm and zen about it. And he always seems to know how to get on the right track of things. And he's fantastically knowledgeable on a ridiculous amount of subjects, like an autodidact. So the point is, it's his calm certainty that helped keep Twin Peaks going in all of the fans' minds after all this time, not letting it go. And when the series was airing, it was the one necessary ingredient that even though we didn't know what the hell was happening, Dale Cooper knew or was going to know. He's going to figure it out. So to watch him back away baffled from the haunted door of the Palmer home and go back into the streets, not into the car that they came in, just standing in the street, stunned, and then physically lever, like it's like he's struck by something invisible. It's a remarkable performance. And he bends over a little bit. He looks completely baffled and just blurts out the question, what year is this? So the person we've been counting on to know what's happening in Twin Peaks, to be the hand we could hold as we go through these, let's face it, just scary mysteries, now can't even identify the place he's at, the people he's talking to, or even what time he's in. And let me tell you, as a Twin Peaks fan, that moment that he did that was like all the air got taken out of the room. And then it gets more awful because you hear Laura Palmer's mom inside the house scream her name. Now, at this point, Laura still doesn't know she's Laura, apparently. But the realization dawns, I think, on her who she is. And she lets out one last incredible, blood-curdling scream. The way that only Cheryl Lee can do. The most heart-rending scream in cinema. There's a buzz of electricity, a flash as all the power goes out and the Palmer go home. And then it goes dark. Now, there are a million theories about what's happening here. I personally think that there are doubles of these people, and sort of like us, the tethered, but not as scientific, more spiritual, and that this false universe is getting closed out by Cooper by coming to this home. But who knows? It could be a million other things that are happening there. The thing I know for sure is that that scream haunted me for weeks, and that ending of that episode is still with me to this day. And to have the weight of fan expectations after a quarter of a century of waiting for this thing to come back, and to pull it off so unexpectedly, so uniquely, so powerfully, and end it in a way that's so good that even as a fanatic Twin Peaks person as I am, I'm nervous about the idea of it ever coming back. And that's not how I felt the way about the return. Before the return even existed, just the idea of Lynch coming back and relaunching Twin Peaks 15 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever would have been nothing but exciting for me. But now, it would still be exciting for him. Don't get me wrong. I'd still be in, but I'd be like, can he match a final moment that good? And then equally as importantly for a horror podcast, absolutely frightening to your core, like chill you to the center of your being. Just fantastic. The gum I liked certainly came back in style. So I've talked about this actually on the first ever episode of this podcast, so I'm not going to go on in length about it. But Lee Winnell's Invisible Man, and I think he's just good at ending, because the ending of Upgrade is also fantastic. But the ending of Invisible Man is just so good because, and I don't have the energy to go through the whole setup to the scene. If you've seen it, great. If you haven't, go watch it, come back. It's really worth your time. It's a really, really well-executed movie, great acting. But the final scene has basically the one word in there's a section of the final moments where nothing is spoken. There's one guy just sitting at a table by himself. We don't even know where Elizabeth Moss has gone necessarily. And then a really gory murder happens. And then you hear one word uttered, which is surprise. And it's a callback to something previous in the movie. And there's a acting that Elizabeth Moss does, changing from being really distraught talking to 911. To uttering this one word in this one way. And it's just an incredible moment, an incredible incredible acting on her part. But it gets better because unlike a lot of other horror movies where the ending is like that moment when Freddy pulls Nancy's mom through the door, you end on that, and then, like, you know, that's the visual that you, when I say to you, what's the ending of Nightmare on Elm Street, that's what you picture, right? You picture the door and the woman and maybe the car and maybe the kids, maybe the credits, but like mainly you're picturing action. But what's really special about Invisible Man is it gets better after the action ends, because as Elizabeth Moss strolls out after she's gotten rid of her nemesis, she meets up with her friend, a friend that has doubted her for most of this movie, who now believes her, obviously, for obvious reasons. And she totally gaslights him. And that is the whole theme of the movie, the entire movie, this toxic relationship she's in, and the masterful gaslighting that she's subjected to, awful gaslighting. She has learned her enemy's strategies. She gaslights the hell out of her friend. And I'm totally here for it because it's a flipping around. And he's an authority figure too, by the way. So she's gaslighting not only a friend, but someone who's in a position of authority. And it's magnificent. It's just such a good turning of the tables from what she's been put through all this time to being able to do this in this way, but use that gaslighting power for good. And then she walks away triumphant. And that's where I get goosebumps, because as she's walking away, in the Invisible Man, ironically, you can't see him, but because he's such a threat and he can come from anywhere, your eyes are basically bugging out of your head. I mean, as a viewer, even, you're like looking for clues of where he is everywhere. And you're always looking in the backgrounds. It's a really rich movie that way, because you're looking at the backgrounds of the movie way more than you do a typical movie. It's kind of like searching for Michael Myers in the shadows in Halloween. It makes your eye take in more of the real estate physically. So her eyes are like bugging out of her head the entire film out of fear, just sheer terror, because of that incredible restaurant scene. We know this person is capable of any kind of devious evil. So she's constantly scanning the horizon like you do when you're watching It Follows for like the people in the background. And then she's walking down this path away from this, the home of the person she's just done away with. And we're just focused on her. It's just her. And she slows down and then stops and then lets out a relaxed breath. The first one we've heard her heave in the entire movie. And she looks directly at you, directly into the camera, and closes her eyes. It's the first time she feels safe enough to close her eyes, and the movie ends. And that touch is so exquisite. It's a little scary that a good people can get driven to the same level of deviousness as the villains, right? Just incredible stuff. Okay, so there you are, the best and or scariest horror movie endings of all time, as done by the Horror Weekly community. And speaking of the community, I want to thank everyone who's been trying to get us over the top with the ratings and reviews. We're still not at that coveted 4.8 spot yet. There weren't quite enough 5-star reviews to get us there. We're still sitting at 4.7, but I see the numbers going up. I know you all are trying, and I appreciate it to the bottom of my heart. And there was a great new review that popped up in on the Apple podcast. And this is funny because it said, excellent podcast. You can participate with the social media, with the questions posed at the community that fuels the topic of the podcast for the week. Very easy to listen to. Great listen. This mysterious podcaster is very insightful. Thank you so much. That's Kim Kim Majors. Really, really appreciate the 5-star review. That's amazing. The reason I bring this up besides the thank you is the mysterious part. So if you've been listening for a while, I imagine you've noticed that I haven't said my name. That's partly accidental, partly just because I get excited about the ideas at hand. And that's what I'm focused on. And I get excited about really having, you know, dialogue and conversation with you all in the community. So that's what I get excited about. I'm sure there's tons of people who follow the page who know my name from there for somehow. But 33 episodes in, I don't know that I've ever said who I was once. But that is partially also on purpose. So my name is George, by the way. And the reason that that we're not leading with this on this podcast is because it's about the community. It's about leaving a record of what horror fans felt and thought and loved at the times that we're asking the questions on the page or in the Facebook group or on Threads or, you know, in this podcast. And it's a truly collaborational thing. And that's what has me a little bit worried here. So indulge me just for a second. This will be really quick, I promise. The Facebook page has more than 500,000 followers now, and I couldn't be more grateful for each and every one of you that are there. But the size of the page has become a detriment a little bit. There's so much activity there. I get so many spam messages. There's like thousands and thousands of comments a day. The activity is like sticking my head into a fire hose. So, and it's sad for me. Like, I miss things. Like, Jackie Earl Haley will, you know, comment on something, and then I see 2 weeks later that he did it. Or Phil Tippett will, you know, say something on one of our posts, and I won't ever, and then they'll obviously, because I didn't respond, they're like, well, these assholes like, didn't even talk back to me. But it's just because so much is happening that I miss it. And I want this podcast to become even more collaborative. So there is a subscription group. I set it at the lowest possible cost you can put it out on Facebook, which is $2.99 a month. It's a Facebook group. There are less than, I don't know, 20 people in this group right now. And it hasn't been that active, but I want to really fire it up. Because here's the thing. I record this podcast, and then when it's done, I see new things that happen on the page, and they're things that I should have talked about in the podcast, and it happens every damn time. Movies that should have been mentioned, brilliant comments that you guys say that should have been talked about, or angles that you see that I never catch. And to make this podcast better, what I want to do is I want to start workshopping it before the episodes are recorded with some devoted, dedicated, willing horror fans. So I want to like lay out some ideas of what's going to be talked about. I want to get ideas about what the topic should be. Sometimes the numbers are, you know, up and down on the episodes, and I can tell that I picked the topic that I was super excited about, but obviously didn't connect as well with like the group. But if I had more people helping me put this together, because I'm doing this completely solo, this is a solo project, aside for this huge community. But now I want to bring the community closer in if possible. And sure, yes, it helps to support. Like, this takes a lot of time, so I have to take a lot of time away from work to do it, and I want to do more time, but like, if there was a little financial support, that helps make that happen. But the main point of it is to have a smaller knit place where I'm not going to miss the comments, where I can have more detailed conversations, and we can truly make this thing together. So this may not work, right? Like, nobody may be interested, and no one may show up in that group, and then, you know, I'll continue doing it, just grabbing what I can from the page, from what I missed. But I really hope that it does work, because I know that the episodes themselves will get better with more in advance feedback than getting all the feedback after the fact, after they're made. So anyway, if you listened through all that, thank you so much. And of course, thank you to everyone who voted on and gave so many thoughtful, cool answers on the endings of movies for this episode. This is what makes it work. So thank you so much for participating. Thank you for listening. And until next Wednesday, have a great horror week. Oh, and I'll put a link to the subscriber group in the show notes of this episode. Bye.